Welcome to Profiles. I'm Steve Sanders. In the next hour, we'll meet someone with a passion for music and performance, as well as a deep commitment to the well-being of students, to the ideals of a university, and to human service. Michael Gordon, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you.
Michael, you formally retired from the Indiana University faculty after a quarter century of service 2 years ago. And at the time, your colleague Leon Foscia wrote a tribute to you in which he said the following, and I want to quote from this and ask you to talk about it. He said, "Michael Gordon has a bit of the buccaneer about him, benevolent, of course, but prying, pirating his way into matters of the human condition that affect our interpersonal lives. He never encountered a problem that he couldn't convert into some sort of opportunity. Multi-talented, he has an immense empathy for his fellow man and has lived most of his adult life in a condition of mild outrage, triggered by whatever impropriety or absurdity bestrode his path."
Wow. I'm flattered. I was flattered when I first heard it, but now it sounds even extravagant.
What do you think these qualities came into play, as we'll talk about, in your various roles at Indiana University? But what instilled these qualities in you? Are they a matter of genes or a matter of the experiences and upbringing that you've been exposed to over your life?
Well, one of the things that helped is I was born as a black person in the Deep South at the height of segregation. I was also born a left-handed person in a right-handed world. I was born a person who was attracted to music in a household of people who were not necessarily attracted to music. So I had to kind of fight my way into all of those realities that I just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. You were born in Florida. Your father was an Episcopal minister, which means you moved around a lot in your early years. For college, you enrolled at Virginia State College and majored in vocal music, and you later earned a master's at the Cleveland Institute. What drew you to music, which would remain and remains today a central defining feature of your professional life?
Well, as a son of a priest, my father moved around from place to place. And wherever we lived, it was a house next to a church. And the church always had, in the parish hall, a piano. And I remember the first time I was struck by this piano. We had just moved to this small town in West Virginia. While everyone else was having dinner for the new minister and his family, I edged my way up to that piano, and I still remember the feeling that I had when I touched that piano. I knew then that I wanted to play the piano. And it took several years and a couple of more moves. We wound up in Petersburg, Virginia, and I finally convinced the high school music teacher to give me piano lessons at 50 cents a lesson, and I went twice a week. We had an old beat-up piano, which all of the keys in the middle of the piano were just so badly ruined that I could not hear what it sounded like until I went to the piano lesson. So every piano lesson was a marvelous, fabulous experience because I was hearing my piece for the first time. I didn't tell her that. So that's when it started.
Okay. You studied music, formerly vocal performance specifically. After teaching in several schools, you earned your doctorate in music and music education from Columbia University in New York. And then you were hired as a music and arts supervisor in the New York City schools. Music and art have long had a sort of second-class status in the public schools, perhaps even more so now than then. What kind of challenges did you face in that environment as a young supervisor, relatively young supervisor, fresh out of Columbia with your doctorate, supervising art and music in some challenging areas of New York City?
Well, it actually didn't happen exactly that way. What happened is I went to New York with an opera company from Cleveland, the Caramore Opera House, and we were singing Handel's Julius Caesar, and that had never been sung in its entirety in New York. And by the way, that's going to be sung this year at the Opera Theater here at IU this fall. But I had a minor role, but I got a wonderful review, and that caused me to want to go to New York to be a singer. And since I had had some experience as a teacher in Virginia, it was a good idea for me to get a job teaching rather than waiting tables or working at Macy's. And I had a friend who was teaching in the junior high school system of New York, and through his influence, I got this job in a school that everyone said was the worst junior high school in New York City.
Where was that?
In East Harlem. It was junior high school number 99 on the corner of 100th Street and 1st Avenue. And I didn't care that they said it was terrible because I thought I would only be there a short time. I had no desire to be really interested in those children because everyone told me how terrible they were. So I steeled myself to be ready for some very bad kids. And so what happened after that was like almost magic. For the first several weeks, I just contended with whatever I had. And I had a kind of a transforming experience one day in which I was rushing home to take my Compose pills. These were like a non-prescription sedative. And it was almost as if an angel got into my car with me as I was driving up the East River Drive. Michael, why are you rushing? I said, because I want to get home fast to get the Compose pills. And the angel said, well, why do you have to take Compose pills? I said, because these kids are getting on my nerves, and I've got to go home and calm myself. And the angel said, but why are you taking Compose? And it suddenly hit me that I had 35 kids in my room. Why not let them be the ones to go home and take Compose? So the next day, I went in with a plan by which I was going to teach them how to behave in my classroom. And we came after school, and one thing led to the other. I became close to them, and they became close to me, and they did not want it to stop. I had been taught that a teacher is supposed to stay on one side of an invisible wall, and the job of the students is to stay on the other side. And I religiously adhered to that until these young people were just one step away from drug addiction, crime, murder, etc. And so my altering what I had been taught slightly was, in my view, to their benefit and to mine, because they climbed over that wall that everyone said you're supposed to have between students and teacher. And I'm friends with some of them today. As a matter of fact, one of them came to my daughter's wedding on June 1st and was master of ceremonies at the reception. Mm-hmm. But I stayed in that junior high school. I got an audition. I won the audition that I went in for. That would have put me in a group that would sing all around the world. And I could not leave that junior high school. I wanted to postpone my journey with the professional group. And his name was Leonard DePaul. Some people may remember him as a fabulous choral man. And he said, Michael, it sounds like you're hooked on teaching. Why not come next year? You can go with the group next year. So I ended up teaching in that junior high school for 4 years, and then I decided I was stuck. Not stuck, but I felt I was called as a teacher. And I decided I would teach at the high school level. So I went and took the high school exam. And I became a high school teacher at Fort Hamilton High School, choral music. And then later, I was called to become the assistant principal of South Shore High School, brand new high school that was opening in the Flatland section of Brooklyn. I had had a kind of a dual career, well, tripart career. From my very beginning, I have somehow drawn into administration, teaching music, and performing music. When I was 22 years old, I was an assistant principal of an elementary school in my hometown. Just after I came out of the Army, I was an officer with the 101st Airborne Division. When I came back to Petersburg, that was a celebrity-type person to come back having been in office with the 101st Airborne Division. So they found an administrative job for me. And so going to become assistant principal at South Shore High School was not a new experience for me. It was a huge school, later became a school with 5,000 students. No, 7,000. 7,000 students. It was the largest high school in New York at one time. I don't know whether it is now. So when I became supervisor of music, it was because an examination was offered for the first time in, they told me, 30 years, in which I became a licensed supervisor of music. And my colleague at the junior high school also took the exam, as a matter of fact, Asta Harrison. She was the one who persuaded me to take that exam. When she became an appointed supervisor of music in 1970, she was the first black person ever appointed as a supervisor of music in New York City. And I became appointed 1 week later. And so I was the first black male. And so the challenge was, well, a lot of it had to do with race in the beginning. Mm-hmm. I went to visit certain schools, and some people refused to accept the fact that I had supervisory power over them.
This was the early 1970s.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I went in and I wrote an evaluation of a teacher. It was a wonderful evaluation. But the chairman of the school music department refused to accept that I could be the supervisor. And so I had to wrangle with that. I had to wrangle with budgetary issues. There was always a cutback for music and art. And so, in a way, I think I was being prepared to become the dean of students at Indiana University.
Prepared for the next phase of your career, which occurred in 1975. At this point, you're in your late 30s, about 39, I think.
Yes.
It seems like many people have their own version of the "I never intended to stay in Bloomington as long as I did" story. But you felt this especially firmly when you came here from New York City in 1975 to
yes.
Bloomington, Indiana. In addition to the culture shock, you said you actually expected a miserable, even perhaps a risky life as an East Coast person here in the small town Midwest. What were your feelings when you set course for Indiana in 1975?
Well, you described it perfectly because my family and I, we were set in New York City. It was just perfect for me. I was an administrator and a teacher. I performed regularly with chamber music groups. I attended the Metropolitan Opera, the New York City Opera Company performances. I went to the Philharmonic performances on a regular basis. I was studying for my doctorate. I had not finished my dissertation because every time I got ready to write my dissertation, some other project came and distracted me. We got a grant. I got a grant to do a fabulous project called Music is Action. And we got over $250,000, which was the largest grant in music education, I found out later, in the United States. And I think that was one of the things that attracted Indiana University to me, because I did not know about Indiana. I knew Indiana University was a fabulous school, but it had never occurred to me to apply to Indiana. And then I got a grant called Operation Steel Drums, and I put steel drums in every junior high school in this very large district that I was supervisor of music in. And so I was very happy, and someone wrote me, Dr. Klotman, as a matter of fact. He was the chairman of the music ed department, and he was that year was going to become president of the National Organization for Music Educators called the MENC, the Music Educators National Conference. So I was quite flattered when I got a letter asking me if I'd be interested in applying for a position that would come available.
A faculty position, music education here at IU.
Right. And I was so busy that I really couldn't even take the time to answer. And so a few months later, I received another letter in which he said, you know, we really would like to consider you, but we cannot consider a person who has not applied. So I wrote back immediately and said, well, I don't even have a resume. I've never bothered to make a resume. I was set to stay in New York the rest of my life. We were very happy there. I had two children. Two little girls had been born in New York. Our lives were very nice. But my wife suggested, why not at least go for the interview since they're going to fly you there? So I flew, and we came to Bloomington. I was very impressed with the music school. I had never seen anything like this. I was taken to a performance of Bartok's second piano concerto, a freshman playing it. I never couldn't believe that Indiana University had five symphony orchestras of students, no overlapping. The opportunity in terms of development as a teacher of music, there's no place like it. So when I was first offered the job, I really turned it down. And I basically, in a funny way, said to Dean Webb, couldn't you just sort of move it? Indiana University, about 35 miles south of New York, then it would be perfect. And then I heard, after I did decide to come, we heard these terrible racial stories about Bloomington. They gave a party for us in New York, in which the name of the party was, "Let's Stop the Gordons from Going to Bloomington, Indiana" party. And they had banners, "Stop the Gordons from Going." And they told us about the death of a young woman who had been killed in broad open daylight, a black woman, in a little town called Martinsville. So when we did come for a while, we were deathly afraid to drive through Martinsville. I one time drove to a school in Indianapolis soon after I came here, and my car broke down in Martinsville. It was just off. I went to the phone booth, and I told my wife, I said, this is where I am. If you don't hear from me for 2 or 3 days, send the search party to Martinsville. Of course, they treated me very politely and courteously in Martinsville.
Mm-hmm.
But those were the kinds of fears that I had.
But you quickly became very well established. Your Bloomington stage debut came only a year after you arrived. In 1976, when you performed the role of Porgy in the IU Opera Theater's production of Gershwin's opera, Porgy and Bess. In fact, we're going to hear you singing a song now from that production, and then we'll come back and talk about it. This selection is Bess, You Is My Woman Now, from Michael Gordon, our guest on Profiles, singing in a historic 1976 recording, the IU Opera Theater's production of Porgy and Bess.
Bess, you is my woman now. You is, and you must laugh and sing and dance for two instead of
Michael Gordon, our guest on WFIU's Profiles, singing in a 1976 IU School of Music production of Porgy and Bess, the role of Porgy. Did this opera have a special significance to you at this time?
Oh, yes. First of all, it was an opera. Early in my childhood, I heard about Porgy and Bess from my music teacher, the same one who taught me piano. And she was my mentor for all things. And she was my first real mentor. And she was the one who introduced me to classical music, and she introduced me to going to performances. There was a professional theater in Richmond, Virginia, and we used to go there, and I often went alone on the bus. And I heard opera for the first time, the Metropolitan Opera. I heard Arthur Rubinstein playing piano there. So I knew all about opera, and I knew about Porgy and Bess, but I instinctively believe something about the way they portrayed it was not exactly right. They said it was not really an opera, that it was a folk opera. Well, I had never heard it. You could only hear excerpts from it. And then in 1976, Indiana University got permission from the Gershwin family, the same year that the Houston Opera also got permission to do the opera in its entirety. Can you imagine? Porgy and Bess had never been performed as an opera. People did not want to accept the idea that Porgy and Bess could be an opera because it used jazz themes as the foundation for its musical structure. And the story was of a poor black community in South Carolina, not long after the Civil War. And at the time when Porgy came out, that with the segregation at its height, there was no way that politically they could accept the idea of a grand opera being portrayed by black people, especially using jazz. I instinctively knew that without having heard the music. So when I heard that they were going to do that here, I just wanted to be a part of it. Also, my third really great mentor, my voice teacher in college, had studied voice with Todd Duncan, who had been the very first Porgy. So I had a chance to sing in that opera its fullness. And I want to tell you, Porgy and Bess is an opera. It's a grand opera. Mm-hmm. And to be able to sing the very same songs that Todd Duncan once sang was just a highlight of an honor for me.
And this must have been quite a triumph, singing a lead role in one of the premier schools of music in the country after having been here 1 year.
Yes, I didn't realize how significant it was since I was a music ed professor. Mm-hmm. And people did not expect music ed professors to be able to perform music. Mm-hmm. Somehow, that old adage that they used to use, if you can perform, perform. But if you can't perform, teach. Mm-hmm. And if you can teach, teach. But if you can't teach, be a music education professor.
In addition to music, to teaching music education, your work in the School of Music, as a faculty member in the late 1970s, early 1980s, you became actively involved in student life outside the music school, served as advisor to your own fraternity, Kappa Alpha Psi, and you acquired the reputation through your presentations, through your work with with students, even mediating once or twice in some racial situations. You got the reputation as a young faculty member whom students would find worth getting to know. And this didn't go without notice. In 1981, the then chancellor of the Bloomington campus, Ken Gross Lewis, asked you to become the campus's dean of students 6 years after your arrival here. This caused a bit of a stir, didn't it? Because it was unusual for someone in that position to come from the ranks of the faculty rather than from people with formal training in student affairs administration.
Yes. There were three aspects of it that were considered very unusual. Number one, I was a faculty member and not someone trained specifically to be a dean of students. Number two, I was black when I became dean. I became the highest ranking black person in the entire Indiana University system. That means all eight campuses, which is very surprising when you think about it. That was 1981. The third thing is I was a music professor, and people had a stereotype view that how could a musician know anything about anything other than music? And, of course, the committee. I did not apply for that job either, by the way. It came looking for me.
What did Chancellor Gross Lewis at the time tell you? What did he say it was about you that he wanted as a dean of students?
When I went to his interview, it was the very last interview before his decision. And so I was really struck by the intensity of the interaction between us. And I asked him, if I became dean, what would you want me to do? What would you want me to be like? He said, first of all, I would trust you and your judgment based on your background about lots of things. He said, but there are two things that are important that I'd like you to do immediately if you were dean. He said, I'd like you to bring the student life more in tune with what the faculty perceives of as the academic mission of this university. And number two, he says, I know this may seem unusual for a campus as large as this, but I'd like you to be visible. I would like for the students to know who their dean of students is.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, you acquired the reputation as someone who wanted to keep his finger on the pulse of what was happening in the fraternities and sororities and residence halls, someone concerned about things like student attitudes on race and alcohol and faculty-student relations. The impression you gave is that you tended to see yourself less as an administrator and more in the role of a sort of traditional small college dean of students, an activist dean in many ways.
Actually, I really did try to do that, and we had many conversations with staff about how we could function in a way that the administrative job of the dean would be taken care of, but at the same time that the dean could be perceived of in a personal way. And so different things happened. For example, alcohol became a very serious issue. It had been not just here at IU, at colleges, and it still rears its ugly head all over the country. But we decided, after I've observed several things on this campus, it took 9 months before I decided to develop a plan. And what I saw on campus was absolutely appalling to me. I visited every dorm on this campus. I went at night. I went at times they didn't had no idea I was the dean. I went to fraternity parties. If I heard there was an invitation that went out for a party, I went. And they served me drinks without any question whatsoever. They were very kind to me and just as nice as they could be. But they were serving their dean of students alcoholic beverages on a campus, which was considered against the regulations of the university to serve alcohol at all in any residence that was predominantly undergraduate. And so the thing that really swayed me in the direction that I wanted to go is I went to a conference of the National Association of Student Personnel Administrators in Boston. And there was a young administrator there from Florida. He was the dean of students. His name was Geraldo Gonzalez. He is now our dean of the School of Education, which is a wonderful coincidence. But he set forth a formula that he had tried, a three-part formula. And I came back to my staff and decided with them that we'd try that. We'd enforce the regulations. We had a history of kind of looking the other way on some aspects of the regulation. We would build a new awareness of alcohol and its influence on the human body by creating something called the Alcohol Information Center, which I did that fall, and then we renamed it later the Alcohol and Drug Information Center. And then we organized a student organization called BACUS, which is a group of students who who discuss responsible ways of drinking. Mm-hmm. We did all those. But the most controversial part of it was the idea that not only did I ask my staff to go and check out the situation on a regular basis and actually confront alcohol violations, I decided if I was going to ask my staff to do these things, that I should lead the way mm-hmm. and do it myself.
And you acquired a certain fame and some at the time might have said infamy because of you talked about how you were very personally troubled by what you had seen and by the damage that was done to the reputation of the university by being considered a quote-unquote party school.
Indiana University was considered the number one party school in the United States according to the Playboy poll that they had been doing for 10 years. They were on the 10th year when I became dean, and they had occupied that position as number one for all of those 10 years. Well, after we inaugurated our alcohol enforcement plan, Playboy decided to take Indiana totally off the poll. As a matter of fact, they referred to their dean in the article about it, and they said he was an enforcer. And they said that he walked around or drove around in a Jeep, and they implied that I was very militaristic. That was one of the many rumors. I became the most famous dean in the United States because the Indiana Student Association president, who became a lawyer soon after that, and so legal things were very close to his heart, he decided that he was going to sue me if I went around and went to fraternity houses and residence halls. And, of course, I challenged him, you know, what court would you like me to appear in? And, of course, I was supposed to just turn tail, I guess, and just stop. The Indiana Daily Student assigned 11 different reporters. 11 different reporters had as their beat Michael Gordon. They followed me around everywhere I went. They tried to find something that they could say that would deter me from trying to do what I had to do. They even interviewed members of the Board of Trustees. What do you think about what he's doing? And I wish I could tell you that I was proud of everything that all of the members of the Board of Trustees said about that. But everyone was afraid of the students' a belief that you would be very unpopular if you enforced the regulations. They even implied that students would stop coming to Indiana University. Actually, we had the highest enrollment the next year that we had ever had. More people wanted to come. Mm-hmm. And the word got around that there was a school in which there was a dean who actually went around himself to check to see what the atmosphere was like for students. Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, a lot of parents actually liked that idea.
Mm-hmm. In addition to the direct sort of hands-on involvement with student life, you couldn't totally escape the responsibilities of a campus administrator. We're going to take another break and play another excerpt of you performing in that 1976 IU production of Porgy and Bess. But I know you have a brief story about how that opera, and specifically the song we're going to hear, figured in a budget conference that you had in your first or second year as dean with the campus administration.
Yes, it was the second year, because the first year I was just learning what a budget conference was. I don't think most faculty members know. The administrator goes in and he presents a program for what he's requesting and why he's requesting, his philosophy or her philosophy for what this whole student life area was about, comes out in the budget conference. And so I went with grand ideas about what I was going to ask for, and of course I quickly found out that it was just perfunctory. You got nothing. You got no, as a matter of fact, you got a budget cut. And so the second year, I decided I would go in and be very dramatic since I had sung in Porgy and Bess. And the big song that Porgy sings is I Got Plenty of Nothing. I basically went in and said, you know, you expect me to be the dean of students of one of the largest schools in the country and give him an almost budget, a zero budget. So I sang I Got Plenty of Nothing.
Okay. We're going to hear the real singing of our guest on Profiles, Michael Gordon, singing in a 1976 IU production of Porgy and Bess, the song I Got Plenty of Nothing.
Oh, I got plenty of nothing, and nothing plenty for me. I got no car, I got no mule, I got no misery. The folks with plenty of plenty got a lock on the door. Afraid somebody's gonna rob them while it's out of making more. What for? knock on the lock on the door, that's the way to be. They can steal the rock from the floor, that's okay with me, cause the things that I cry, like the stars in the sky, for me. Oh, I got plenty of nothing, and nothing.
Our guest on Profiles, Michael Gordon, singing in a 1976 IU Opera Theater production of Porgy and Bess. The story you told about going into one of your first budget conferences as a dean and using that to describe the budgetary situation. I understand, though, that the Chancellor, Ken Gross Lewis, had a quick-witted reply for you when you made that plea.
Yes, he reminded me that the song also said, "Nothing's plenty for me." Actually, I would love to describe the relationship that I had with Ken. It was a wonderful, unusual one. He would say, they would say, "No, you cannot have this." But then either he or one member of his staff would come and talk to me privately and help me figure out another way, by some other means, to get the funding for this or that. Mm-hmm. And he gave me a philosophy during that early period that stayed with me the rest of my term. He said, whenever you go and ask for something and the answer is no, find out how much of that thing that you want to do can already be done by some other means. Mm-hmm. And just do that part of it that you can do that you don't have to ask permission to do. Mm-hmm. And I use that.
In that tribute that your colleague in the School of Music, Leon Foscha, wrote for your retirement 2 years ago, another thing he said was that in your approach to the Dean of Students job, you were unfettered by existing models, making it up as he went along, guided by his intuition and the splendid ear he developed for sensing human needs. He says you viewed yourself as your own best troubleshooter, and that was part of this very personal approach to the job, wasn't it? It was something, in a way, though, that you had to make up as you went along.
Yes. In a lot of ways, no one had access to some of the aspects of the job that I did. The only way I could get someone who was comparable to what I was going through was to talk to other deans at other schools just like this one. For example, early in my career as dean, I got a phone call from a very worried parent in South Bend. And she started her conversation by saying, you know, my daughter has a roommate who is black, and it's a very dangerous situation. I'd like to get out of that situation because the other black kids come to the room and they hang around, and it's just an awful situation. She said, and you know how those blacks are. And I said, yes, I do. I said, more than that, more important than that, though, I'm a parent. And I said, and I have two daughters also, and I know what it's like for your child to be far away from home. And you're concerned, as a mother should be concerned. Within 24 hours, your request will be granted. I said, and by the way, when you're in Bloomington, come by and see me. And she said, oh, no, the dean of students will be so busy and important. I said, no, I would never be too busy. I wanted to see her face when she came to see me. The very same week I got that phone call, I got a call from a father in New York City who told me that his daughter, who was black, had a white roommate. And it was a terrible situation. Indiana University is a racist institution. I own several radio stations, he said. And if you don't grant me my request to have my daughter move, I'm going to promote it all over the country that Indiana University is racist. And you know more about what that is like down there. And, of course, he was assuming that I was white, being the dean of students. And I said the same thing to him. You are a father and your child is a long ways from home. And your request will be granted within 24 hours. Mm-hmm. When you come to Indiana University to visit your daughter, come by and see me. Well, those two incidents are what gave rise to the idea that I want to have a forum to find out what is the status of racial understanding at Indiana University. I went to Gross Lewis and I asked his permission to do that, and he encouraged me. And so we had our first forum, and we had testimony from all over. And we found out from the sources themselves that mm-hmm. we had a serious problem mm-hmm. that was not being addressed institutionally.
In 1989, when you were dean, you gave an address to the Bloomington Campus Faculty Council in which you lamented that so many faculty members don't get a sense of the richness and vitality of campus life, probably don't have the kinds of experiences that you've described because they don't spend much time outside of class interacting with students. In that speech, you said, "We have recognized here at Indiana University that a residential university is more than its heating system, its parking spaces, its basketball games, even more than its classrooms and libraries, that its integrity is lost if it abandons its commitment to the total life of its students." Does that remain a concern to you, that faculty don't have these kinds of experiences really deeply getting to know students?
Yes. I tried to do something about it. As a matter of fact, one of the things that Ken did ask me to do specifically when I became dean of students, he said a bunch of faculty members are concerned about this very same issue, and they want to organize a fellows program in one of the dorms, a residence hall, Briscoe. And I took his suggestion, and we organized that right away. And then during the course of my 10 years as dean of students, we organized a fellows program like that at every residence center. So I tried, through my administration as dean, to give the faculty member an opportunity. And a lot of faculty members do avail themselves of that. But what I was addressing was an administrative technique, which I think is a very wonderful technique, called responsibility-centered budgeting, where you quantify. And I was just reminding the faculty, because I was the representative of student affairs, giving his annual report. I was kind of reminding the faculty that there are certain intangible things about this campus, especially Bloomington, that cannot be quantified. And then if you develop a budgetary technique that works, you've got to figure out a way to factor in the interrelationships between faculty and students that occur on a campus like this, which is a residential campus, more so than many other campuses mm-hmm. like it.
You stepped down after 10 years as dean in 1991, but you continued your work with students in other ways. You served as executive director of the National Panhellenic Council, an organization made up of historically African-American fraternities and sororities. But there was also an incident on this campus some years ago in which another fraternity, Zeta Beta Tau, got in some difficulty because of an alleged hazing incident that they had involved their pledges. They were suspended from the university. As a way of helping them get back on their feet with the university, you took them on as a project. You offered to work with this group to help them find some more, to rediscover their values as a fraternity. What led you to take on a group like this that had been reviled by much of the rest of the campus community for engaging in hazing?
Actually, like so many things in my life, I didn't volunteer to do that. That sort of fell into my lap. As a matter of fact, I was one of the protesters outside because the incident had many racial overtones to it that were really quite nasty, asking the students to pretend they're black and then go and steal and things that were offensive to women, to older people, to the handicapped, to Latinos, to Asians, all of that. And it was really almost like a lesson in an opportunity for a lesson in diversity. But it was the executive director of the Zeta Beta Tau who had known me in other circles. As a matter of fact, I had won one of their national awards a couple of years earlier because of my work in diversity. He called and asked, would I act as what he called an honest broker? And so I went over to the Zeta Beta Tau house, and I had a conference with them in which I described who I was and what I would do if they wanted me to work with them. And I asked them, I said, I won't do this unless you want me to do it. And they gave me a standing ovation and asked me. And so we had diversity every Sunday night for 1 year in which people came and volunteered by email. We had a press conference to announce that we were going to do this. So the word got out. And the quality of the presentations that were given was out of this world. And they created a special forum for diversity, which I assume, I hope they're still continuing. So it was a wonderful teaching moment for the university.
And not only was it an opportunity to talk about issues of diversity, but also I assume that one of the things that led you to agree to do this was your belief, stemming to your own experience, in the value of college fraternities, another type of organization that's sometimes misunderstood and even reviled on a college campus.
Absolutely. And I waver back and forth between two values about the fraternity. Some things that they do I just think is absolutely ridiculous. And sometimes I find myself with the faculty members across the country who believe that fraternities and sororities should be abolished. But then I remember my own experience as a fraternity member and some of the things I witnessed as an advisor. By the way, I got involved in my fraternity again, not because I wanted to, because of a fine old man named Herman Wells, who at that time was a chancellor, and he had a work-study student in his office that had been subjected to an incident with Kappa Alpha Psi. And he found out that I was a new faculty member, and he wrote me a letter and said, "I understand you're a member of Kappa Alpha Psi, and there's a student who is involved in an incident. It sounds very suspicious to me. Would you look into that?" And I looked into it, and one thing led to another. I became their chapter advisor, which I remained for 11 years. Mm-hmm. By the way, I later had a chance to call on Herman Wells for a favor similar to that. Because I, as dean of students, I was having an incident with the Sigma Nu fraternity. I was getting calls from all over the country to try to get me to desist in my enforcing certain things with Sigma Nu. And I went to him and I said, "Now, you asked me to get involved in my fraternity several years ago. I'm going to ask you to get involved in your fraternity. Either you want me to continue as I am or you don't. If you don't want me to, let me know and I won't." Well, I never got another phone call after that to ask me to desist.
Michael Gordon, in retirement from the university, you have felt pulled in toward two different vocations, both of which are linked, and I want you to talk about that. One involves time that you have spent in the African nation of Ghana. The other vocation involves your decision recently to study for the Episcopal priesthood. I want to ask you to talk about those first. What led to the connection that you've established going back and forth as you have in the last few years to Ghana?
Well, it started back in 1986. One of our former students who became a professor here later, but this time he was the operations director for Operations Crossroads Africa, invited me to go on a tour with a bunch of administrators and educators of Operations Crossroads Africa, which took me to Senegal and the Gambia. And while I was there, I had this transforming experience. I went to one of those slave castles on Gore Island, and I realized that some of my ancestors came from Africa on the ships from those places. And I decided I was going to explore that in my retirement. I may just go and live in Senegal. And a few years later, one of my brothers went to Ghana on a spiritual journey. And while he was there, he had a similar transforming experience in Ghana. And he not only considered that he would move to Ghana for his retirement, he already bought the property. And so since my brother is a quadriplegic and he's married to a nurse, I figured, why have my brother in Ghana and I in Senegal? Let me check out Ghana. So I went to Ghana. Again, the same person later was a professor at Butler, and the Christian Theological Seminary in Butler sent people on a tour of Ghana in the summer. And I got on that tour. And I had a similar experience in Ghana as I had in Senegal. And so I felt a calling, a real spiritual pulling to Ghana for some reason. I didn't know exactly what. And finally, I decided I would have a guest house that would make it possible, easy for students and faculty who wanted to have an experience in Africa to come to Ghana. Let me help make it easy. People said that I would be a good bridge person between America and Africa. So that's how that happened. About the same time, I got a calling for what am I going to do with the rest of my life? The first third of my life was about preparing myself for life, education, and work. The second third of my life was marriage, children, and work. Now I'm in the third of my life. I've been told by a prophet that I will leave this physical body at age 93. So I retired at 64. What do you do between 64 and 93? Do you watch television? Do you play golf? Somehow I think I'm supposed to do something more to pay back humanity for all these fabulous blessings that have been given to me and to my family. And so the idea was planted in me by Phil Amerson, who was my Methodist minister. I had become a Methodist.
The former pastor of First United Methodist here in Bloomington.
And then he became called to be the president of a seminary in California, Claremont Seminary. And he asked me to consider the idea of being an associate pastor. Of course, I thought that was ridiculous, just as I thought coming to Bloomington would be ridiculous, just as I thought being dean of students would be ridiculous, working with ZBT would be ridiculous. But those things fell into my hands by some divine power, I think. And so by that same method, I have now finally discerned that I am being called by God to minister. We all are ministers in some way. But for special ministry, that I think, I haven't figured this part out yet, that it will involve Africa. So I'm beginning theological studies starting this fall on a part-time basis. But eventually I intend to attend an Episcopal seminary in New York City to prepare for the priesthood.
And in this way, you'll be following in the footsteps of your father, who was an Episcopal priest.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I was born in a church, literally in the church called St. Michael's and All Angels, and I was named Michael because I was born in that church. My mother's room was being repaired, and they moved her temporarily in a room called the sacristy with a stained glass window, and I was born in that room. So I'm returning.
Mm-hmm. How often do you get back to Ghana? What does your travel and the part of the year, the part of your life that you're devoting now to Ghana involve?
I go every year, sometimes twice in one year. I've been to Ghana now 8 times, and I took my entire family, my 2 daughters and their mom, last summer, and then I returned back to Ghana when they came back here. Now I'm working on a project. I have a son, a young man who calls himself my son, who lives in a village in Ghana called Bunyuri, where they weave cloth called the kente cloth for the chiefs. It used to be for chiefs. Now this kente cloth has become like a symbol for Africa. And so I'm now on a project with a professor of costume design at Butler University. She and I are designing liturgical garments made out of kente. And the purpose of this is not only to acquaint Americans with the beauty of the kente that can be used in liturgical services, but also to give new life economically to that village.
Mm-hmm.
I've also been involved in the starting of a new school, which will open in September in Accra, Ghana. It's called the Ghana Academy of Film Arts, and I'm on the board of directors mm-hmm. of this brand new school to teach people how to make better film in Ghana.
Mm-hmm. When your studies for the priesthood are complete, you will take up a position in a church. You will minister in Ghana. How do you envision spending that period of your life after having become a priest?
I have no idea. I am 65 years old now. The study for the priesthood is a 3-year program, Master of Divinity. And then you become ordained, if successful, through all of this, as a deacon. You spend at least 1 year as a deacon. So by my calculations, I will become ordained as a priest at age 70. And by that time, through my study and meditation and consultation, I think I'll know by then. I don't know now.
You are someone, you've made reference to this several times in the interview, you are someone who believes that your path, your destiny is guided in a certain way. You've referred to guiding hands, to prophets, to messages you've received. You have a certain faith that you will be given a sense of what your destiny is at the appropriate time.
Yes. And it comes to me in all kinds of ways, usually through messengers of God, and those are us, other people, even animals, dogs even. One of my dogs became, I think, a messenger of God. Anything that points you to your destiny. And I think we are messengers of God, and I want to come more fully into the realization of that.
Our guest on WFIU's Profiles has been Michael Gordon, Professor Emeritus of Music at Indiana University, former Dean of Students, and now embarking on a new journey in life. We're going to leave the program, Michael, with one more excerpt from your performance in the 1976 IU production of Porgy and Bess. And this song has a particular significance to you at this point in your life.
Yes, Porgy has just found out that Bess has gone to New York. He had no idea where New York was. He got his goat. He was a crippled man. He could not walk. But he got on his cart and headed towards New York. And he's looking for Bess. Oh, Bess, oh, where's my Bess? And in many ways, Porgy is pretty much like where I am in life right now. I'm headed for something. I don't know exactly where I'm going or exactly how I will get there. But I feel faithfully that I will find that destiny.
Thank you for being our guest on Profiles.
Thank you.
Oh, The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in August of 2002. Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Paskash, Luann Johnson, research assistant. Copies of this and other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. In addition, this and other Profiles programs can be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening.